Good. Now I have a pedagogical problem to, can you hear me if I put this in, to discuss with people, which is that since there are philosophers here and mathematicians and physicists, not everybody knows about Yang-Mills theory, and not everybody knows about Lie groups and Lie algebras. So I'm going to be rude to the people who know something about these things for the next 15 or 20 minutes. And I'm also going to be rude to the people who don't know these things, because I'm not going to give a very thorough introduction. But I hope that's okay. And what I would encourage is, and I forgot to put this on the reading, but we're not going to use very sophisticated aspects of the theory of Lie groups and Lie algebras. There are many different textbooks on various levels of rigor or not, and I would just ask, if you're not up on the stuff, please, over the next week, and I'm happy to consult with people about what I think are the best ways to do this, but please brush up or read through an introduction. These things. At the level that I'll be doing it, a nice book is the book of George I, Group Theory for Particle Physicists. But there are many, many, many equivalent places. And I'm also going to flavor my remarks with, you know, history, but it's fake history. But maybe somebody here knows better the real history. Okay, so the story about Yang-Mills theory goes back to an argument that's attributed to him and Weyl. I don't know if it really is due to him and Weyl. And again, many of us have heard this argument, but just in case somebody hasn't, and also because the issue of gauge invariance and the meaning and the role of gauge invariance is part of what we want to discuss. It's a big part of the issues about the meaning of time and diffeomorphism invariance, so we want to scrutinize the kind of arguments that people make. So the argument that used to be made is that in quantum mechanics, and I'll just deal with quantum mechanics from a particle, one writes the Schrodinger equation, IH bar psi dot in the notation that we've gotten used to. So psi is just a wave function, and it can just be a function of x coordinates and t, again, in three dimensions. And there's the Schrodinger equation, del squared plus d potential of x, all acting on a wave function psi of x. And there's a well-known symmetry, a mysterious symmetry, that says that if you take the wave function as a function of x and t, since it's complex, and you take it to a different wave function, which is a phase e to the I phi times the original wave function, nothing changes, because the probabilities are all functions of psi complex conjugate psi, and so nothing changes. And this symmetry is related to the conservation of a current, so it has physical meaning, but so Weyl is said to have argued there's something peculiar about this. And what's peculiar is that I have a symmetry where I have a wave function for an electron over all of space and time, and I imagine I'm making a rigid transformation where I'm changing the phase of it by the same multiplication, by the same factor, everywhere over all of space and time. And how could I do that? How could that make any sense? If we have a symmetry, shouldn't the symmetry be local? And when we come back to be trying to think carefully and scrutinize what we're saying, when we talk about gauge invariance, the question that we want to scrutinize is this argument that somehow it makes sense that symmetries or invariances must be local. If we have equivalent descriptions that vary by changing a phase, we should be able to change the phase locally, so phi should be a function of x and t. And that was presumably or said to be the input of Hermann Weyl to worry about that. It was actually motivated by an issue about conformal invariance in general relativity or gravitational theory, but I'm certainly not going to tell that story. So, again, this is a story, and please criticize this if you don't believe it or you're hearing it for the first time. Once we make the phase factor a function of space and time, the Schrodinger equation, I forgot to say, of course, that the Schrodinger equation goes to itself because the phase factor just pulls out. But the phase factor no longer pulls out. D by dt of psi goes to d by dt of psi prime, which is now e to the I of the phase factor times d by dt of psi plus a term with a derivative acting on the phase factor, and that term looks like e to the minus I phi times I times del t of phi. So we pick up a derivative of the phase factor, and the Schrodinger equation is changed. And Weyl said, but in this mythical account, I'm looking at you, is it, you're the closest to historian. Is there any evidence that this is actually
what happened? I don't know if this was his argument.
Okay. I've heard it attributed to Weyl, but Weyl said, well, we like this principle of a local phase factor, a local invariance. So we're going to invent a new notion of a derivative. And we're going to say, instead, we're going to deal with a Cobain derivative in time, which is going to be defined by del t psi plus a field, sorry, del, this is derivative in time, plus a field, the time component of a field, times psi. And some people put I's various places. I'm going to, I will put the I there. And then one asks that when this transformation occurs, the field A goes to A prime, which is exactly what we wrote down, A prime, put a change, sorry, AT minus the derivative of the phase factor. And then this goes under the transformation to e to the I phi times the Cobain derivative of psi, which is the Cobain derivative of psi prime. So, and I feel like I'm not making this as beautiful as I could, the point is that by adding to the notion of a derivative, a field multiplied times the wave function, and adding this peculiar property whereby when we change the phase, we add a gradient to the phase to that field, we can fix up the Schrodinger equation. And if we do this not just with respect to time, but with respect to time and space, then we are back to the definition of what a gauge transformation is. And therefore, the idea is that, and this is an informal argument, so I'm making it roughly, but this is now the derivative of A minus I times A squared, and this is the covariant derivative, del t minus I, and I think I've been messing with signs, plus I, nt times sine. So this covariant derivative makes the Schrödinger equation covariant. And since always a phase factor pulls out, whenever you write currents, and currents are now things that involve psi complex conjugate psi with some covariant derivatives in them, the currents are now meaningful. And one can do define meaningful quantum mechanics. Okay? So this is the story, or a story, about where gauge invariance may come from. The question, and well, before I get to my question, one then wants to know, what should we do with this vector potential, which now has a transformation law like the vector potential in electromagnetism? Should we give it dynamics, or should we just leave it there? And some principle that anything should have dynamics that could have dynamics suggests that we should add to the action principle for the theory an action principle which gives this field dynamics. It should be invariant under these gauge transformations. So we invent the field strength by taking the curl of the vector potential. We make an object that's gauge invariant. And we take the simplest thing we can make with it for Lagrangian, which is a square. And then we get electromagnetism. So then we have a story about where electromagnetism comes from. Okay. So, and so, you know, on the seventh day, et cetera, there was life. Okay. Just out of reach. I think I need two more blackboards for this story. I mean, it's a shame to erase this because we're going to be just modifying all these equations ever so slightly in 10 minutes or so. Okay, now, historically, apparently pretty quickly after that argument was understood in the 19-teens or 1920s, and then a number of times since, people wondered about the following thing. One has fields in particle physics which have components. So one has a field psi I, oh, I don't want to use that I, I'm going to use a capital A, which, where my indices capital A, B, C, etc., stand for 0 and 1, two components. And so there's a psi 0 and a psi 1, making a two-dimensional complex vector. One interpretation of this is that this is the wave function for protons, and this is the wave function for neutrons. Because that's the way that people used to do particle physics for protons and neutrons were fundamental. Now, there is a symmetry. Now, we don't believe it has much significance. But in the 1940s, it was believed to be, once the neutron had been discovered, a fundamental symmetry, which is that this called isospin, that the strong interactions don't depend very much on whether the particles in collisions are protons or neutrons. The electromagnetic interaction cares because protons are charged and neutrons aren't. But they're about the same mass, so the hypothesis was that the nuclear reactions are invariant under a set of transformations that mix up protons and neutrons. And what that means is that these fields could be taken to some transformed fields, psi prime A, where there's some matrix UAB, psi B, where UAB is a 2 by 2 matrix which was assumed to be unitary, and determinant 1. And this is posited to be a symmetry of the strong interactions. That is, there's some Schrodinger equation for interactions of nuclei, which has wave functions for protons and neutrons. And in the same sense that the original Schrodinger equation is invariant under changing phases and doesn't change the physics, the assumption is that if you make everywhere a unitary 2x2 transformation that mixes up who is a proton and who is a neutron, physics doesn't change. And to the approximation that you neglect the differences in the masses, it's true. And it's an important symmetry in the experiments that people were doing at that time, as well as in the spectrum of nuclei and so forth. This is real stuff. Okay. Now, I'm not going to teach group theory, but there are notions of continuous groups. And so the 2x2 unitary determinant 1 matrices form a group, and that group is called SU2. A group is an algebra where the products are defined, there's an identity, and inverses are defined. And again, if you're not up on group theory, please become up on group theory. It is also an important fact that we'll need is that any such matrix U, and now I'm going to drop the indices, can be written as the exponential of an anti-Hermitian, let me be a little bit, the exponential of a matrix A, where A is anti-Hermitian and trace free. And that means that minus I times A can be expanded as a sum over three basis elements for the Hermitian matrices, tau A, where tau A are the three Hermitian matrices, and I'll even write them out in a basis, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, minus I, 0, and 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Okay, there's a general result about the algebras and Lie groups that Lie groups can always be written, the group elements can always be written as exponentials of algebra elements. And I think I'm going to come over here. Do I come too close to the television here? Does this work? Okay. And a property that we're going to need is that such anti-Hermitian matrices two by two matrices form a Lie algebra, which is also called SU2, although usually with small letters S, small letters U. And the properties of the Lie algebra are an algebra where there's an anti-symmetric product, and there's the Jacobi identity, and I'm not going to bother to write it down, but again, if you don't know it, these are things to be learned, sorry, the minus sign. And in particular, the commutator of TA with TB looks like I epsilon AB C times tau C where epsilon 1, 2, 3 is equal to 1, and this is totally anti-symmetric. Okay, so these are facts that we'll need about this group SU2 and the Lie algebra associated with it. Okay. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Why do you need the conditional on the determinant
theory? I don't. It comes from the particle physics. So I don't need it, but I put it there. Okay. Now, it's not, again, the history attributes this following thought to different people, to Hermann Weyl, to Kaluza, to Klein, to Yang, to Mills, to other people. And the thought is the same as the thought that we just had regarding the phase factor. If we have a symmetry, if physics is invariant under a symmetry that changes the definition of who's a neutron and a photon, then why does that work rigidly over all of space and time? Because how does it make sense? If I have a symmetry in an experiment, I have to control what the definition of a proton neutron is on Saturn and Alpha Centauri and, back a billion years ago and 10 billion years in the future. It doesn't make any sense. The argument is that these transformations should be a function of space and time. Local symmetry. And I put symmetry in quotes for reasons that we'll be discussing. But this is what people said. Shouldn't these symmetry transformations be local? And then the same argument intercedes. I'm trying to save some blackboard so I don't have to rewrite everything. So the same argument is the following. I have in a dynamical theory derivatives of my fields psi A. If these go to derivatives of psi prime of A, which are derivatives of matrices U, A, B, psi B, which are functions of space and time, then this is U comes out, A, B, times the derivative of psi, where the derivative acts here, but then there's the terms where the derivative acts on the u's, so I have to have a term that looks like u inverse. And I'm going to just contract there, I'll put the indices back in a minute, times the derivative of u, whole thing, so let's see, this is b, whole thing, b, c, psi c. So I have, whereas I had before to worry about a phase factor, e to the minus I phi derivatives of e to the I phi, now I have to worry about the inverse of u times derivatives times u. And what am I going to do about that? So the same argument suggests itself. The argument is that if you want to make a sensible theory, we should define a covariant derivative, WA, which is equal to the ordinary derivative times psi A plus now some set of objects that look like vector potentials, but that are themselves matrices, where these objects, A, themselves live in the Lie algebra of SU2. So these are for every mu, that is for every space and time coordinate, these are anti-Hermitian matrices. And then one wants this to be covariant, which means that del mu has to transform, and I hope I get this right, like u del mu mu inverse, in order that the theory can be invariant, that is, the theory can be well defined. In other words, when psi goes to u psi, so I'm dropping the derivatives here, and I'm dropping the indices. The psi's are two component complex vectors, and the u's and the a's, and hence the derivatives. So I put an identity matrix here that goes A, B, and then I can remove this psi here, and so that's a better way to write it. The derivative operator times an identity matrix, 2x2 identity matrix, plus A, which is a 2x2 matrix for A mu, is a 2x2 matrix for every mu that multiplies the psi's, and if it transforms like this, when the psi's transform, then nice things happen in the dynamics, because del mu psi just goes to u times del mu psi. So the transformations always come out of the derivatives. Okay. So that's how this story of Yang-Mills theory got started. And people said, that's cool, but we want to give these, now we have things that look like vector potentials, but rather than being real numbers, they're valued in a Lie algebra, that is, they're 2x2 traceless anti-Hermitian matrices. We want to have an object analogous to F, the field string, which is gauge invariant, or at least gauge trans, or at least transforms with no derivative. It's too much to ask that it doesn't transform, but it should transform without derivatives. And if you think about what that has to be, you can think that if I take two of these D's and I define a commutator of them, and I act on psi, that because of the way the D's transform, this object will transform in such a way that the U's always pull out of the derivatives. And so this is defined to be an object F mu nu. And again, the psi's are 2x2 vectors. This is a matrix of 2x2. The F are for every mu and nu a 2x2 matrix. And you can work out what they are. It's convenient to write the 2x2 matrix expanding their anti-Hermitian matrices, so we can expand them in a basis. So there's the sum of A and I times F mu nu A times tau A. And I'm actually going to put the minus I there so that the F's become Hermitian. Otherwise, I'll certainly screw up some things that I'm doing in the future. And it's not difficult to just, now I understand we're doing a lot of stuff quickly, but it's not difficult to actually just compute what the components of this object are, and I'll write it down. I'll write it down on here, because we're going to need it again. It starts out W, A, U, minus del nu, A, U, but now there are three A's, so the, this index A, which stands for 1, 2, 3, for the three Pauli matrices, comes out, and then there's just one more term, which is the epsilon ABC, A, U, B, A, U, C. And the big mystery is there a one-half there? I do not think so. But there is a one-half in some related expressions. If somebody knows, tell me whether there's a one-half there. I did not check this. Okay. And then in particular, under the gauge, I'm calling these already gauge transformations, f mu nu goes to u f mu nu u inverse. So these transform nicely. Yes?
That statement, the definition of A?
Which?
The dot line over there.
This?
Yes.
This is the definition. That comes from the commutators of two covariant.
Yeah, that's the definition of F, but yes. We're introducing A as a way to express F, aren't we?
I introduced that up here. I introduced A here. I define script D as ordinary derivative plus the A's.
Yes, okay.
Okay?
Okay. Sorry, I think with your current definitions there is a half. And the reason is that your commutation relations are wrong. Because, well, again, they're missing a half.
Good. Just tell me where it's most convenient to correct me. Is it?
If you stick a 1 over root 2 in terms of all of the matrices.
Thank you.
Then you're fine.
Then I'm fine. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, and then if we want to write an action, the action that we want to write is analogously to this one up there. We want to square the f's. So we write d4x, the square root of the determinant of g, f mu nu, f alpha beta, eta mu alpha, eta mu beta. Okay. And now the new feature is that these f's are 2 by 2 matrices. So I just multiplied 2 2 by 2 matrices, so I have a 2 by 2 matrix, so I should take the trace. And this is now, since I took the trace, this is invariant because the action is a scalar. So we've achieved the dynamics which has this idea that there could be invariance under a local symmetry. Okay. So that's the basic story of how the Anneaux theory gets set up. I need just a few more equations. And then I have to trace through what we did before. So that will be a boring part where we redo everything we did. You see, it's very much like electromagnetism. It's just that inside these f's, there are some higher order terms. And so I'm going to need a few more equations to deal with that. And I think if I can just come back here and use these boards here, that'll be good enough. And what in particular I need is the infinitesimal form of those gauge transformations. So if I write again, U is E to the I, some parameters, boy, what shall I call these parameters? Rho A tau A. So that's a way to parameterize the anti-Hermitian matrices. Then for small rho, this looks like 1 plus I rho A tau A. And so I'm just going to write everything for small. And I can also write this as just 1 plus I rho, writing rho. So I'll often be doing this going back and forth between a basis of 3 parameters and 2 by 2 matrices written explicitly. And then the covariant derivative del mu, let's see, so is that the expression? No. What I need is the actual how the vector potential transforms. So A mu A goes to A prime mu A, which is A mu A plus the covariant derivative of some quantity rho A, where if I write out just what that means, and I'm sorry if this is boring, but just to get the notation down, so we're going to be doing these over and over again. But epsilon A B C A mu B rho C. And don't trust me either for signs. So the variation of A is now the covariant derivative. The A component is some covariant derivative of 3 functions. And the variation of the F transforms by U, F, U inverse, and the leading order term brings down the A times the F from here, and then on the other side, minus the F times the A. So there's a commutator. So delta F, when we write it as a 2 by 2 matrix, transforms like the commutator of rho with F. So the delta F A transforms like epsilon A B C rho B F C. Okay. Sorry for these boring formulas, but they're going to be very helpful for us in a little while. Okay? Well, let me see what I can. Will people be annoyed if I just go back to the same blackboard and correct the definitions? Let's try it, okay? So this is now Yang-Mills. F has now, there are now 3 Fs plus epsilon A B C A U B A U C. The trace becomes a sum over these new components. Ooh, and we're about to have a meltdown of notation because we have 2 different meetings for A's. Okay, that's my fault. So we're going to underline these new meanings everywhere. Okay? When it matters, when there's 2 different notations. If you stare at this, you'll see that the entire effect of the nonlinear terms here is to make this a covariant derivative here. And we now have, I'll call some index C, 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 C. That's the internal gauge index. I really apologize for that. Here's now 3 pi zeros, and they're all zero. So that's what it was before. The definition of pi has, now there are 3 of them, I'll put a C with an underline, is now 3 pi A's. And they are what they were before with the new definition of F and a covariant derivative here. So if you're not totally, we'll come back to this. If you're not totally pissed off at me, we now have the basic start of Yang-Mills theory. And basically, what's happening is that every time there's, not every time, but most, every time there's a spatial derivative that appears explicitly, it's been made into a covariant derivative.
Why not temporal derivatives?
Not temporal derivatives. And that's because there's not a 2 here. So you only get one of these to go along. In other words, F is not the covariant derivative anti-symmetrized. It's one, the covariant step comes along just on 1.
Okay.
Is
there sum on C, right?
There's a sum on C everywhere there are 2 of them. Like here, 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 here. Okay. And this blackboard is pretty much what it was, except that this is a covariant derivative. And what that means is that this blackboard is what it was, except in the, when you integrate by parts, remember we did integration by parts, to put this covariant, to put the derivative on the pi to make the g, that's now a covariant derivative. And that's an important enough equation that starts to be a difference, so let me write that out. So g, there are now 3 g's, gc of x, and that's the covariant derivative, a pi a, with this extra index c, and I'll write that out explicitly, that's del a pi c plus epsilon c d e a d pi e a. And I apologize, I'm doing something I told you I couldn't do, which is I'm doing some summations. These epsilons, I'm doing some summations with indices, both upper, both lower. And that's just laziness on my part, because I want to avoid, okay, I'm just going to put it lower. The metric in this internal 3x3 space, GAB, is just delta AB. So raising and lowering has come for free. Okay, so everything in the definition of the Hamiltonian theory is exactly the same, except that this F has nonlinear terms in it. Because the F is linear and quadratic, and in the G, there's a nonlinear term. It's not just a term linear in pi, is a term of the field A times pi. Okay. Now, questions, because we went through that rather quickly.
So in the E and in the E and M case, the physical significance of the G was that was the divergence V, which was zero because there were no charges and so on in the free space. Is there a physical significance of this?
Well, it's not the divergence. And roughly speaking, what that means is that the field lines can interact with each other. And let me postpone, we will, at least in the quantum theory, talk about that explicitly, the implications of that. And there's a similar issue in general relativity precisely at precisely the same moment, which we'll get to when we get to general relativity. Okay. Now, I've done all of this so I could do now one calculation. Because there's now one thing which is different. And that one thing which is different has a lot of consequence. So a zeroth order thing which is different is that the field equations are now nonlinear. Because everything's stemming from this quadratic term here. So the field equations are now nonlinear. They're hard to solve. The solutions are non-trivial. There are wave solutions, but there are lots of other solutions. The theory, the insistence on this invariance principle has brought along interactions, has forced interactions on us. So if we didn't bother to vary to find the equations of motion, but the equations of motion look like Maxwell's equations, but everywhere you had an ordinary derivative before, you have a covariant derivative. As before, the A0 you can forget about, but the A spatials you can't. So the dynamics is nonlinear. And another consequence is that now the calculation of the Poisson bracket of the G's with the G's, and let me as before define G of rho. So we had it before. And again, I'm doing the same thing. The pi's are a density as before. So, and the covariant derivative is a density. So I'm now summing over some three functions, rho c of x, d3x, gc of x, because we're now three g's. And now I want to take the Poisson bracket of two g's. And I'm going to do it by having a g of something called rho and a g of something called sigma. And now I want to take the Poisson bracket. And now it's not trivial. It used to be trivial because when it was just this, it was a Poisson bracket of something that was only pi's with the Poisson bracket of something that was only pi's. Now, there's the A in here. So there's something non-trivial. And by the way, just as before, we can write this as minus the integral d3x, the covariant derivative of A of rho index c, pi A index c. So we can integrate by parts, put the covariant derivative on the rho. That will have as a consequence, if you follow the same logic, that delta A, delta rho A, is now defined as the Poisson bracket of A with g of rho is now the covariant derivative with rho, and I should remember these guys have these extra e's to the c. So again, the gauge transformation comes out to be what it should be, and now the gauge transformation has a nonlinear term, which here it is up here. It comes out to be what it should be. So g generates the right nonlinear gauge transformation. And now if I compute g with g, however, it's more complicated because of the A in here. And let me do this sort of carefully. Just let's see if I can get it right. So this is the integral d3x of the Poisson bracket of the covariant derivative of A, and this is with derivative of X, times rho C, plus epsilon C D E, A D A, all this multiplying a pi, and all these are fields of X, C, and it's the Poisson bracket of that with G of sigma. And there are now, and I forgot that there's a rho in here, a rho E. There are now two, and then there's another term where I exchange the roles of rho and sigma. So minus rho and sigma switch with each other. There are now two things I need to compute. The Poisson bracket of G with the A here, and the Poisson bracket of G with the pi. Let me do a little side calculation here. What's the right way to do this? Hold on. Well, G with pi, let me just point. G with pi is going to take the derivative of A in here. And the A is in here. Here's the covariant derivative. And G with pi, this is a fraction. Well, I guess I should just do it. Everybody is looking sufficiently confused. I'll do it. GC pi at the point Z with G of rho. The operative term, the only term that matters, is the A in here. So that's the integral of D3x. The rho comes outside, so there's some rho E that doesn't matter. There's some epsilon C, blah, 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 blah. I have a C there. Okay, I'm trying to do too much too fast. This is the integral d3x times the Poisson bracket of pi c a of z with, and let me write it out, the derivative by, say, v of rho f, I'm sorry if this is boring, epsilon f g h, rho G A H B, everything multiplied by pi B and F, and this is all at the points X. Now there's a Poisson bracket here. The Poisson bracket is with pi. Pi with pi doesn't matter. So I can put the Poisson bracket here. The only thing that this pi will pick up is this term here. And so what this is going to be is there's an overall epsilon. There's an epsilon C D E. There's a factor of the rho, which is multiplying one of those indices. And there's a pi, which is outside, which multiplies another of those indices. And the pi has an ordinary index A. And these are all bar. I feel like I'm in a notational crazy house. In any case, this is delta rho of pi. And you notice what it does is it's just linear epsilon times rho times pi. So the change in rho of pi a c is just proportional to pi. And basically what this is, if you think of this three-dimensional space as an ordinary three-dimensional space you learned about in high school, this is the cross for every component A. This is the vector cross product between rho and A. So you can think of this as rho cross pi in the underlying variables for every vector A here. So you can think of C. So you can think of this like a rotation. It just rotates the pies around an axis given by the rows. So now I've told you what delta A is. I've told you what delta pi is. So you can compute G with pi. And that's just going to rotate the pies, leaving you this left over, which is G. Well, this left over is the derivative of rho, and then you're going to get a pi from rotating the pies. Okay. So I'm just going to write down the answer, and I'm going to suggest you go through it in your spare time. The answer is that this is the integral d3x of gc at the point x times epsilon C D E times rho D times sigma E. In other words, this is G of the function, which is rho cross product sigma. So what happens is G with G is another G. And there are many ways to write that. Let's see if I can get a little bit of space. Is that all right if I'll just write it in a different way? G A of X cross on bracket GB of Y is epsilon ABC times GC of X delta 3 XY, and to be really precise, it's this plus GC of Y delta 3 y of x to keep all the density weights straight. That is, this is a density in x and a density in y. This is therefore a density in x and a density in y and a density in y and a density in x. Okay? So you have what I promised you was a possibility, which is an interesting object, which is basically at every point of space, the G's are acting like a Lie algebra. They're reproducing the commutation relations of which was written, just buried somewhere under all of that, are the commutation relations that say that, well, let me just put it here by contrast. Tau A, tau B commutation relations is epsilon A, B, C, and all of these are underlined, tau C. And you have that algebra essentially acting at every point. So it's like at every point of three-dimensional space, you have a little Lie algebra going on, which is the Lie algebra of SU2. Okay. So the system works like before, like electromagnetism, but there's some nonlinearity in the system. And as a consequence, rather than the G's just commuting with each other, they make a nice Lie algebra. And strictly speaking, it's an infinite dimensional Lie algebra because there are an infinite number of G's. There are three G's at every point. And they make a nice infinite dimensional Lie algebra like this, which looks kind of like a lift to space of the Lie algebra of SU2. so it's not a trivial object. Now, the same speech, and I apologize for the technicalities, but the same speech is to be given about the Hamiltonian as I gave before, which is that as I evolve, I think I've erased that, but as we evolve the fields, there are contributions from gauge transformations. So I only am free from gauge ambiguity if I discuss the dynamics of some gauge invariant object. And it's no longer true that, say, pi is a gauge invariant object. Pi in electromagnetism was a gauge invariant object. Now there are three pi's, and they rotate amongst themselves under gauge transformations. And they do so arbitrarily at arbitrary points of space and time. So the only gauge invariant objects are things like the trace of pi A, pi B, where I trace on the 2x2 matrices, where I can write that as pi A underline C, pi B underline C. Those are gauge invariant objects. But the simple pi's by themselves are not gauge invariant, and similarly for the magnetic field. So there are fewer gauge invariant objects than there were before, and there's a more intricate gauge symmetry. Now, yeah, let me just make my last sentence. Something interesting happened in the course of going from Yang and Mills and the argument that I gave about making the symmetry between protons and neutrons local, and Dirac, who was the person who figured out everything we've been talking about. And the thing that happened is that something that was seen as a symmetry changed into a gauge invariance. And I want to emphasize this point, then I'll take a question. What we see is that a symmetry is different from a gauge invariance. A gauge invariance is an ambiguity in the evolution. It is an unavoidable term in the Hamiltonian with free coefficients. And what we've seen is that these terms have to be here for the consistency of the theory. And what that means is that, again, if you take a symmetry to mean a change of the physical situation that leaves the Hamiltonian invariant, which is what it usually is the definition of a symmetry, and we usually think of things like translation or changing protons to neutrons, these are active physical transformations that take us between distinguishable different physical states with the same energies. A gauge transformation is not that. A gauge transformation is a change in the mathematical description of a single physical system or a single physical history. And the way we see that is by an argument, and I think this argument is due to Dirac, about determinism. That is, this is classical mechanics, and you're now faced with the following choice. Given initial data, the evolution of the A's and the pi's is not determined. There's a large class of future A's and pi's consistent with initial data now. Initial data, that is initial data even that satisfies the constraints. The only way to have a deterministic dynamical system is to say that what's physically meaningful is the whole equivalence class, and therefore the observables are only the gauge invariant functions. The pi's don't mean anything, the a's don't mean anything. The only thing that is an observable that could correspond to something measurable in the system is a gauge invariant quantity. And that's not true of symmetries. So there's a clear distinction between gauge invariances and symmetries. And the point of Dirac's argument, which is framed in this notation, is that this is the way you have to regard gauge invariances if you want to have a sensible deterministic dynamics. Okay, so are there any questions about that? That's sort of the key point. point, and the intricacy of local gauge invariance is another point. That is, all the, you know, I'm sloppy, and I hope you're not as sloppy as me, but, you know, all the equations on the board fit together in an intricate way. Now is much more intricate because the nonlinear terms are always coming in exactly the right way to guarantee that there are gauge invariant quantities that are meaningful. If you go back and you reconstruct everything that's going on, so there's a lot of intricacy in this. But what it does is quite impressive, because what you've done is you've said that there's a 3 times the dimension of space infinity of ambiguities in evolution, which are sitting inside these dynamical, this SU2 gauge theory, SU2 Yang-Mills theory. And nonetheless, somehow these things are relevant to physics. I mean, if the Yang-Mills equations had not turned out to be the foundations of our understanding of the interactions in particle physics, we wouldn't care so much. But interestingly enough, and unforeseen by Yang and Mills and other people, these, you know, until the middle 1970s, early 1970s, these turn out to be the fundamental dynamical systems that particle physics seems to be describing. Okay, questions, comments? Yeah.
So we have this gauge invariance because, in the first place, instead of writing just the wave function with one component, we wrote it with 2 components. And then you say, if I cannot distinguish them, then I can rotate freely inside. But so mathematically, we started in the first place with this redundant description. Because I would ask, why didn't you just start with just one component? The reason is that, in fact, there are 2 components that have a physical meaning that is being a proton or a neutron. So it seems to me that.
No. I want to disagree with you. But finish what you're saying, then I'll disagree with you.
So what I want to say is that either we started from the beginning with the redundant description, or they correspond to physical degrees of freedom. And if they correspond to physical degrees of freedom, then it's a symmetry, not a gauge structure.
Good. So if underlying it there is some physically meaningful distinction between what's, let me just call it psi 0 and a psi 1.
Yeah.
Okay. In this formulation, then if we take these equations of motion, which follow from that action principle, then we do not have determinism. As we cannot deterministically determine, if you start with all psi 1 somewhere, what will be the evolution in the future. And I didn't carry out this. I haven't put the size in. If I could put the size back in, and the story is the same for them. So the price of believing that these things are distinguishable is a breakdown of determinism. And that's the point that I was making. I was deliberately vague in how I made the argument, because if you read the paper of Yang and Mills, they really believe that they're distinguishable. They write as if they're distinguishable. Now, of course, they had a physical interpretation in mind, which turned out to be incorrect. For example, they believed that the 3-vector mesons here, which is the language that they used, were some particular things called rho mesons. Okay? And the fact, and there were some, you know, embarrassing things like the rho mesons have mass, and with a little bit of analysis, you can show that these degrees of freedom don't propagate as if they're mass. This, with more analysis, you discover that neither classical nor quantum mechanics is there a well-defined meaning, completely well-defined meaning for what it means to propagate these degrees of freedom because of the lack of determinism. If you want deterministic propagation, you have to express it in terms of objects like this. And you can do so. You absolutely can do so. And you can account for every degree of freedom that the argument of Dirac says should be there. you can account for it, and you can discuss its dynamics. But then you can't distinguish protons from neutrons because this is a sum over the square of the electric field for protons and the electric field for neutrons, if you like. Okay. Now, I think it's good to talk about this because the same issues are going to arise for diffeomorphism invariants and the interpretation of general relativity in space and time. They're even trickier because the analog of gauge invariants, which is diffeomorphism invariants, moves things around in space and time. Okay. So one reason I wanted to do this first is we better be clear at this level. This is much simpler conceptually than the issues that face us with general relativity or any, you know, string theory or any of the diffeomorphism invariant systems. And already there is this subtlety. Now, you know, it now becomes a very interesting question. What are you allowed to do and what are you not allowed to do? You know, are there physically meaningful observables that ask you a question like this? Supposing I arbitrarily choose what's a proton locally, I just make a decision and I invent some measuring apparatus. Can I do that? What happens to them? Can I? Can I still have some of my desire to have these things distinguishable? And I think the answer is no. But you really have to fight through, you know, examples and really convince yourself that these are the only observables you get. If by an observable you mean something that, given consistent initial data, is going to have a deterministic value, a completely determined value at any future time. If that's what you mean by an observable, then you just do not get to distinguish invariantly what's a proton from what's a neutron. And that's all in the mathematics on the board.
If it is only, yes, if I also have electromagnetic fields, then
if you also have electromagnetic fields, okay. So then what you're saying is, just a second, okay, can I add to this, supposing I take the dynamics based on this, okay, and now I add to it, I say, oops, okay, now I'm going to have some other field, okay, and so I'm going to have some interaction, and in the interaction I'm just going to take, say, pi 0, okay, and let's say I'm going to couple that to the electric field of the electromagnetic tensor, or something like that. Okay. So now I'm going to add here terms which don't have all the gauge invariants. Supposing I do that, okay, what goes wrong when I crank through all of this? Okay, do you want to take a guess?
Well, that the covariant derivative is not covariant anymore, right?
Well, it's certainly no. All the covariant derivatives are covariant derivatives. Well, supposing that I just arbitrarily break the gauge invariance in some interaction to some other degree of freedom. Okay, what's going to go wrong?
Constraints will be first class.
Yes. Yes. The constraints will no longer be first class. That will be the sign that you've broken the gauge invariance in the dynamics. And what will happen is that the theory will try its best to let you have your way, but now the Lagrange multipliers will have to become determined functions to get consistent evolution. And we could do an example, and I certainly don't want to do one now in the last 2 minutes, but we could do an example and really see how breaking the gauge invariance explicitly forces the Lagrange multipliers to be dynamics, which makes the evolution of gauge-dependent quantities deterministic. That's if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, there are just no solutions. Yeah, I think Harvey was next.
Maybe I missed something in the argument. If you have a dynamical system whose equations of motion are locally, have a local symmetry, and in particular local in time,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to face another determination problem. And that means that the transformations won't have an active interpretation. You've got to look for observables that are invariant under these transformations.
So you're saying have an argument basically to the same conclusion?
Yeah, I'm just wondering why you need the direct formalism to see that. I mean, why couldn't somebody have come along to right at the beginning of this theory and said, well, if you want to make this transformation local, you're going to face another determination problem if it's local in time.
Mm-hmm, okay. I don't have a ready answer. I mean, certainly the discussion could have started, and I'm sure the discussion was going on. What Dirac allows us is a very useful tool. I don't think that this is some platonic reality about something. I think this mode of analysis is a very useful tool to separate out what's physically meaningful from what's gauge dependent, and as a bridge to the quantum theory. It's extremely useful. It's not the only bridge to the quantum theory for gauge theory. There's something else called BRST invariance that I'm not going to talk about. It was developed much later. But it's the conception, in my view, it's the conceptually clearest bridge to the quantum theory that lets you make useful guesses about how to address the same issues in the quantum theory. And we will be coming to that event today.
Yeah. What's the downside to disengage in quantum?
Well, we're not there yet, but the there's no downside if you do it right. Okay. And doing it right means making sure that, maybe there's a question I want to deal with later, okay, but roughly speaking, since you brought it up, fixing the gauge is like adding extra constraints. And if you want to destroy the gauge invariance by adding extra constraints, basically you want to do what you just said happens. You want to start piling on extra constraints that the equations of motion don't call for till you make every constraint second class. And then you determine all the evolution uniquely on that smaller constraint surface. Now, there's big issues about can you always do that? When can you do that? You know, typically, there's something, for example, called the Grivov ambiguity. That says that you can't over the whole phase space. I don't remember the precise statement, but in the class of things that people use as gauge fixing in a perturbative theory, do not actually fix the gauge correctly. So for example, you want to make sure that you count one for one. So now you have these big equivalence classes, the big infinite dimensional fast equivalence classes. You want to make sure that every equivalence class gets knocked down to one solution, not three or five or zero. And these are highly nonlinear infinite dimensional spaces. And it turns out that in the Angular's theory, it's very difficult to do that. I don't think it's impossible, but it's difficult to do that with a choice of gauge fixing that makes any calculation possible thereafter. And that problem is related to a problem that's called the Grivov ambiguity. To the extent that I wasn't going to go make this a course in all the things that go wrong in the quantization of the gauge theory, but if you want later on, because we will come back and quantize the Agnos theory as a warm up to quantizing gravity, so we can certainly do this on then. Okay. Any questions from Guelph or Weston before we stop? Okay. Thank you very much. So see everybody in a week. Thank you. Thank you.